You're listening to Decisive Point. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm talking with Colonel Michael J. Kelly, author of Understanding Russian Disinformation and How the Joint Force Can Address It, which you can find in the summer 2024 issue of Parameters. Kelly is a U.S. Army reservist and a military governance specialist. He's a distinguished graduate of the U.S. Army War College and the Advanced Strategic Art Program. Welcome to Decisive Point, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about your article. Give me the working definition of disinformation.
That's a great question. Lots of different agencies and academic sources define it differently. I think the most useful way to define disinformation is false or exaggerated information used maliciously in order to mislead or deceive a target audience.
What is Russia's approach to disinformation, and why does that matter to the United States?
That is both an easy and difficult question to answer, I think, because Russia's approach to disinformation is very, very broad. If there is a method that can be used to deceive or to misinform adversaries of Russia, Russia uses it. There was a RAND study a number of years ago that described Russia's approach as a fire hose of falsehood. I think that's a terrific way to describe it. Russia is not married to any need to be consistent with the way that they inform their target audiences, and they are very, very comfortable tailoring false messages to be used in different environments. In my paper, I offer an example of a news story that went out in an Arab language source that talked about bioweaponized birds being released from Ukraine in order to fly into Russia and poison people and damage crops and things like that. When a British news source encountered that, they investigated it and found that that story had originated in Russian nationalized media sources. And for us in the United States, that seems sort of an absurd story. We recognize that that's not something we would do, despite the fact that we were blamed for it in this story. But in the audiences they were targeting, those in Russia, in their own country, and those who are not in the West, those stories can resonate a little bit and build distrust in the United States. That's one method to their approach. Another is where they'll take information that is maybe true or partially true, and they'll exaggerate that story. We've seen that recently. There are some open source articles that discuss Russia's use of the immigration controversies here in the United States in order to overemphasize perhaps the impact of illegal immigration and to make that a wedge issue in the United States and one that is sort of on the other side of the scales from providing additional funding and resources to support Ukraine. And that's how it's strategically important to them. They're a little bit all over the map, but they are consistent in that they are constantly using disinformation in order to advance their causes.
How does Russia use disinformation in Ukraine?
Kind of like I mentioned before, they'll use disinformation to target those in the West who are interested in assisting Ukraine by promoting controversy surrounding aiding Ukraine. Most recently, they've been targeting the legitimacy of the Zelensky presidency. They've been emphasizing corruption stories and things like that to include falsifying stories where Russian sources have done things like there was a recent controversy about senior Ukrainian officials owning expensive yachts and vacation homes abroad. And that story sort of went viral and in part led to the dismissal of a senior defense official in Ukraine. But upon further examination, you found that the photos that were cited in those things, those were from real estate websites in France and yacht sales websites elsewhere. Completely untrue, but it sows distrust. And you see the arguments in our own media here in the United States about why should we support Ukraine when the government is so corrupt, when many of those stories are false and they've been re-emphasized by Russia. They've been using this sort of approach dating all the way back to when Russia illegitimately seized control of Crimea, promoting stories that there was genocide going on in the Donbas and Luhansk regions, stories about uprisings in support of Russia from within Crimea and those regions. And those were all patently false, and yet they were repeated multiple times on Russian media and continue to be reported in the discussion today outside of Russia.
What should the joint force consider regarding disinformation and information warfare?
The good news story here is I think that the U.S. joint force is beginning to understand that information and information operations are a tremendously important part of our arsenal. We see that in the recent publication of a new information operations doctrine in the United States Army. Similar doctrines being upgraded across the Joint Force right now as we speak. But I feel that the Joint Force should consider going a little bit further than what is listed in that doctrine. Very rarely on any given day are combatant commanders engaged in kinetic operations out in their areas of responsibility. But every day they're engaged in the information fight, whether they want to be or not. Silence can be considered part of an information operation. And the United States is so very cautious about what we put out there that usually we find ourselves on the back foot with respect to information. And I would offer that we would do better towards achieving our national strategic objectives if we were a little more engaging in the information space, a little more aggressive, and particularly faster in getting our information out in order to both counter disinformation and to promote true information that is to the advantage of the United States and the West to share. Furthermore, the Joint Force is constantly engaged in a variety of ways that we support our allies and partners around the world. We're very, very comfortable sending military forces forward to train our allies and partners in how to be more lethal in kinetic operations, how to be more effective in using military force. Where I think we all struggle worldwide, both in the United States, within the Joint Force, and with our allies and partners, is in information literacy. And one way that we can combat disinformation is to inoculate ourselves against it by being more literate about the information we consume. And I think that the United States is well positioned to support our allies and partners in doing exactly that. And I could see a future where our civil affairs teams, our psychological operations teams, and others are forward working with our allies and partners and helping them learn to vet and decide what information they receive on a daily basis that they are going to accept as true and use in their decision making.
Did you learn anything that surprised you while you were researching this article?
To a degree, I think I did. Since the revelation of the use of the so-called Russian troll farms to disrupt a previous presidential election in the United States, this has sort of been a passion project of mine to better understand disinformation. But I became sort of surprised that when I talked to friends and colleagues about it, there would be a hand wave. Yeah, the Russians lie. What's new? And that dismissive view, yes, we understand they lie, let's move on to the real issue at hand, surprised me because it seems that their information operations are effective and that we're just not very excited about countering. Information literacy does not sound like the most sexy topic in the world, but I believe it's a very important one. And I don't think there are enough people that really understand it. I found that surprising. It's not just the young adults. It's colonels and sergeants major, both within the force and retired senior civilians. You know, it all becomes very easy to get set in our ways and to not challenge the information that we receive. One of my favorite analogies that I use is, if you get a piece of information and you slip it on like that old comfortable sweatshirt that your wife has been trying to get you to get rid of for years, and it just feels so good to put on, that should light off warning bells. What you're feeling, that comfort, is confirmation bias. You're feeling this piece of information, you're receiving it, and it makes you feel right. It hasn't really added something to your knowledge. It's confirmed something you already believe to be true. And discipline that I've tried to promote for myself and that I encourage others to consider is that when they get a piece of information that feels like that, they should hold accepting that information in abeyance. That should sit in the inbox until you challenge it. Go to an opposing media source. Attempt to disprove that piece of information before you accept it as true. That's labor intensive. It's difficult. And it's certainly not the way our information environment is constructed today for us to receive information via social media. And every government office you go into has a news program on the television. You're just sort of being blasted with this stuff. But for matters of importance, we should pause and we should examine this information. We should challenge it. And only when we can't disprove it should we accept it as true. That is how we discipline ourselves to not become victims of disinformation, misinformation, or any of the other tripwires that we run across.
Do you have any concluding thoughts you'd like to share before we go?
My last concluding thought really would be to my colleagues, both in the military and in the national security establishment, and it would be to foot stomp what I just said. We are responsible for ourselves. We are responsible for making sure that the information that we accept and that we believe, it's reasonable that we think that it's true. And that requires testing it. It requires making sure that our beliefs can be supported by evidence objectively, and we should be willing to accept uncomfortable truths, like sometimes we're wrong. There's a great TED Talk out there that I was introduced to at the War College. I regrettably forget who was the provider of the TED Talk, but what she said was she reminded people that being wrong feels very much like being right. When we're wrong, we don't realize it. And it's only when we challenge these things can we understand that, in fact, we were wrong and be able to change our beliefs so that we can be closer and closer to right. That's on us to do that. As senior leaders, it's our responsibility to do that, especially when we're advising the most senior leaders within our government.
If you happen upon the link and want me to include it in the transcript, I'm happy to do that. It sounds like a good TED Talk.
I'll see if I can find it.
Thank you so much for making time for this.
I'm happy to do it. I enjoy the topic. I think it's an important one.
Listeners, you can read the article at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Look for volume 54, issue 2.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Conversations on Strategy, SSI Live, and A Better Peace.